Hello, friends, and welcome to my attempt to continue with the video work on the six stages of discipleship. Remember that these pages also are written out in commentary that is more exacting, let us say. But I think there is some value in the work of the video. It's a very important section somehow. And let's just make sure that I am recording here properly. Okay. I hate to go through everything and then discover I have not been recording. Okay, so we're beginning program number eight. It's on page 707. And well, you know, I used to speak very quickly. Maybe too quickly for myself and too quickly for my listeners. But now I'm attempting to be more ponderous and to take time for things to really sink in. So this is the 2nd of June. I'm going in these presentations more slowly than I would like to. I've explained the reasons why this is so, and I'm simply trying to overcome some difficulties which slow me down. Maybe I need that. And anyway, this material is highly important and of value. So we're beginning on page 707 with program number eight, the six stages of discipleship, SXS stages, discipleship video commentary. Okay, moving onward then. In the Aquarian Age, which is now so near, relatively speaking, and let's say that this was, let's see if I can do that. Relatively speaking, this was written maybe 180 years or so before the Aquarian Age actually would begin in the year 2117. So written, let's just say about 180 years before the beginning of the Age of Aquarius. Well, I guess in the way that Tibetan counts time, this is actually not much time at all. There will be an externalization of the inner ashram upon the outer plane, and we'll have among the externalizing masters, we will have Moria, and I think K.H. Kurumi, and we will have an English master, probably along the third rate line, an English master. And we will have also, excuse my spelling, Master R. He's always externalizing. He was very much before the mind of Europe at the end of the 18th century. So Master R, and also expressing right human relations, the peculiar keynote of his ashram, Master DK. Maybe we would not have thought that Master DK was particularly expressing right human relations, but so it is, so it is. In other words, that would be his special focus. Disciples, initiates, and world disciples, note the distinction there, because world disciples generally are considered those who have achieved the third degree. We'll meet for the first time in human history as disciples recognizing each other and recognizing the master of their group. You know, especially in certain planetary centers. I don't know if I could assign the centers. I suppose Master Moria's group will be in Darjeeling, and it looks like the Tibetan was making some strong attempts in New York. I'm not sure how else to do that. I mean, you know, they have a certain ubiquity, you might say. But in the five planetary centers, we are told that masters and their high initiates and the disciples of those initiates and so forth will be externalizing in preparation for the Christ. And the year for the Christ's return is not given. Certain conditions have to be met, but let's just say that the age of Aquarius, its technical beginning, is given as 2117. Anyway, meeting for the first time in human history as disciples, recognizing each other, because so often the problem of recognition is considerable, and recognizing the presumably, in many cases, the externalized master of their group. The inner ashram is a focus of souls, free and unlimited. The outer ashram, under the future Aquarian experiment, and, you know, look, he's always careful to call these hierarchical initiatives by the name experiment. We might say, that this is the Uranian nature of these initiatives, the experimental planet, Uranus, planet of occult mind, will be composed of personalities and souls. But what's interesting here is no personalities per se in the inner ashram. Limitation will therefore exist. The personality is going to provide that limitation. Just as in the world today, there is a great battle going on between the dweller on the threshold, which turns out to be actually the personality of humanity, and its soul nature, represented by the angel of the presence. Responsibility will require conscious recognition, and there will be a necessary slowing down of both action and perception in the outer space-time world. We cannot rush these issues. If we do, we're liable to make mistakes, and we want to proceed as free from error as may be possible. So, you know, when we talk glibly of being a member of an ashram, let's say, it is so often being a kind of representative of the inner ashram through the outer ashram. And of course, we may be inaccurate. We may simply presume we're not really going to represent that inner ashram in any conscious way, unless we are an accepted disciple. Now that can occur between the first and second initiations, just as it did for so many in DK's group that he had gathered as accepted disciples in relation to his ashram. By the time we are truly initiates of the third degree, we're going to be both souls in the ashram, not necessarily the inmost part of the ashram, but really within the ashram. And we will have an outer personal presentation, which really does represent what the divine plan is trying to do through that ashram. I guess we need to find out these things and not presume. We need to discover them through experience. The true ashram, of which the coming outer ashrams will be but reflections, the inner ashram being much more powerful and larger, is not for lower concrete minds discussion. And that's interesting. It is a focal point of receptivity. It embraces the effort to establish mutual contact through an united recognition of the vision of the esoteric basis of life and the laws governing action. These are the things that go on in the true ashram. It is not a place, however, for long and silent meditation processes, for it is a point of tension where together the ageless wisdom in its more esoteric aspects is discussed, where the nature of soul relationship is recognized, and where the fusion of auras and the interblending of the triangles goes forward consciously. Now remember, the soul is often called the triangle, the interblending of souls. I think he does not here mean the triangle's work per se. And boy, this is an important one. The ashram is a state of mind of a spiritual group. It is a point of united thought. It is the center for the clarification of the vision, and not of physical plane methods of work. So I'm going to make that section rather larger, because it is so important. A state of mind of a spiritual group. So it involves mental consciousness, and that mental consciousness is of the abstract mind and of the transcendental mind, which is another name given to the intuition. And note that in an ashram, thought is united. I think there is not so much deviation, or what we might call debating or arguing. Debates are held, as they were held regarding the speed with which humanity should be exposed to the ageless wisdom, and that was certainly taking place on higher levels. A center for the clarification of the vision. How clear is our vision of what has to be accomplished? And not of physical plane methods of work. These are worked out by the disciples and the discipleship groups themselves. And a lot of freedom is left to that working out. As disciples learn to integrate themselves into a master's ashram, and that tells us that they are not taken in and forcefully integrated, they themselves have to adapt to ashramic methods and make the necessary transformations in their mode of expression. So as disciples learn to integrate themselves into a master's ashram, they discover that the first thing they have to do is establish a basic harmony, an underlying harmony, a foundational harmony between themselves and their fellow disciples, and to reinforce the contact between their own souls, the ashramic group, and the master. Well, you know, for those of us who are really interested in becoming ashramic workers, this is sound advice. The first thing is the basic harmony. So I think when DK discusses first things, we should really, you know, take note of those statements. Then they learn to comprehend in the ashram through discussion and experiment the nature of the energies which are seeking world expression and the nature of the forces which must be reduced to powerlessness, because the ashram will help to neutralize these countervailing forces, which are basically misleading, deluding, obstructive. So these forces must be reduced to powerlessness if these new incoming energies are to prove effective in bringing about the desired changes under the plan. But note, through discussion and experiment, it's not that place for long, silent meditations, etc. It's a working center which has the goal of world work. So there's been a considerable decentralization that has occurred before a disciple is truly admitted into the ashram and is not simply standing on the periphery. I think the way so many of DK's students were standing, they did not yet achieve these things, even though clearly the requirements were presented. And in the book, Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1, maybe, you know, the first 100 pages or so, you know, the last 100 pages or so, the actual page numbers are different, but what you had to do was clearly presented by Master DK. What will work and what will not work? So, discovering. What will work and what must be offset? The difficulty of the work increases all the time, but the soul camaraderie increases, and therein lies a real a real strength. They learn also, see, the ashram is really a place it's a place of deep learning. They learn also that there is no weakness, no strength in themselves as individuals, which may not be submitted to the group gaze. And thus they arrive at the stripping away of all the veils which prevent the clear light of the soul from shining. Well, there is a, that's quite a statement. And many people, you know, from shining forth, many people cannot tolerate this group gaze. They become overly overly sensitive, and they become personal when they are subjected to the group gaze. I suppose it's something one must simply get used to. Each sees and knows the villainy of each. And yet, with that great revelation, there is no turning back, no spurning of each other, no shakiness upon the road. The road goes forward into day. So, you know, it's a humbling experience, I'm sure. And we would only call it humiliating if we still have so much lower personality and, lower egotism, in which our consciousness is invested. There's a difference between being humbled and being humiliated. The goal of all work, yeah, by the way, this word, the group gaze, is somehow, for me, one that I remembered. And one that stands out in my mind. Basically, in an ashram, we're not hiding ourselves. And everybody is within the ashram quite perspicacious, very perceptive, with the perception of the soul. The goal of all work done in the ashram of any of the masters is truth on all levels and at all times. Now that is another gem of a statement. And so we see that if we do not practice the truth in little things, we're not really preparing ourselves for the kind of work that has to be done in the ashram. What is the truth of the matter? Not how we would like it to occur, not how we might exercise wishful thinking or delude ourselves into thinking that something false is occurring when something far more real is on the level of truth. It will be humbling. But to be humbled is the faster way to be carried away by our glamours and illusions, is a bit like living in a fool's paradise. We're glamorously, illusorily happy that we think things are thus or so, though there may be that little niggling of the truth within us, which makes us at times feel uneasy. But we are wasting time with obstructions, with chaotic actions, with misleading glamours and stultifying illusions. And when we wake up from that, we will realize how much time actually we have wasted. As disciples learn thus to work from a point or center of light, understanding the truth into which they are being steadily integrated, their exoteric usefulness and effective service will be greatly increased. We don't want to be useless. I remember a long time ago, but you know, I worked at the Arcane School and we all had our intake interview. And Mary Bailey was the director. She told a story, you know, she basically said, "Why are you here?" And I kind of said, in order to be useful. Of course, the Tibetan, in one point, he says, what makes you so sure you are useful? And Mary Bailey told the story that Foster Bailey had said, "Well, at least let me be useful." So, exoteric usefulness and effective service increasing when our deliberations are lighted, light-filled, infused with the presence of the soul, and when we understand the truth. So then disciples will, as a group, know what has to be done and find eventually that it is done. I guess it's astonishing to think that we may not really know what has to be done. So can it be that we waste much time in not really knowing what has to be done? I would say, yeah, it can be. We imagine, we wish, we dream, we are misled. But gradually, as the lower ego subsides and the disciple becomes increasingly decentralized, then the light enters in. Well, you know, this is the Tibetan here speaking the truth. The major task of the master in the early stages of training his disciple is to bring to an end the period of the disciple's intense preoccupation with himself. We may think it is not true, but this is how the master sees it. His preoccupation with his service, with his reaction to the master, or the promise of future contact with the master, with his own ideas, which may be quite inaccurate, anent discipleship and his personal interpretations of truth. So sometimes we have first things and major things. This is one of the major tasks. How does he do it, you know? Certainly the disciple will be humbled in the doing of when subjected to these methods. Intense preoccupation with himself, with his service, with his reaction to the master, or with his promise of future contact with the master, with his own ideas anent discipleship, and his, and note the word personal, his personal interpretations of the truth. It's not necessarily the way the ashram sees it. In fact, most probably, it just isn't. But this is a place of training, and gradual integration will occur. Maybe I should call it a point of tension of training. So it's the, you know, the point of tension, the state of mind of a spiritual group. The master takes a group of people with fixed ideas, which they are entirely sure are correct, being the best and highest they have been able to grasp to date, and with the conviction that they have reached a point where they have registered certain spiritual values and concepts, where they have evolved their own formulations of truth, and where they are eagerly demanding the next step. So this is kind of how we would enter an ashram, even if we are included in the ashram. This is our initial state. Fixed ideas, over assurance, because we just don't know any better. Full of conviction that we have arrived at truth, when our truth is simply maybe a tiny bit of the truth, that the larger perspective sees. And so we think, okay, we're on standing on a good basis. We have formulated truths about which we are justified to have conviction. And tell me more. I want to know the next step. Well, what is that? The first thing which he has to do is using a strange or a strong and perhaps a strange phase is to blast them wide open. I remember from arcane school days, there was a secretary, you know, a mentor, well practiced, but who decided that it was her task to blast her students wide open. Well, maybe the master knows how to do this, but we can understand that errors in both direction and technique can be made by the presumptuous disciple who decides to do some blasting. Anyway, to use the strong and perhaps strange phrase, to blast them wide open, to give them a deep sense of insecurity as to the formulas and symbols of the lower concrete mind, and so prepare them for the reception of newer and higher approaches of truth. It must be, wouldn't you say, an uncomfortable and, again, humbling moment for the disciple, newly entered into the ashram of which he or she expects so much of growth and progress and so forth. And this blasting, apparently, this sense of insecurity, this is frequently brought about by forcing them to question all conclusions of the past. Now, maybe we have seen in the Tibetan's letters to his students some of this process, which blasts and, well, it's not quite a word that seems correlated with the Tibetan's technique. He generally is skillful and gentle, but he did say he would tell the truth, and he has had to tell the truth to quite a few people who really didn't want to hear it. Well, we have all, disciples and initiates of all degrees, to enter the secret place of initiation with a sense of blindness or loss of direction. This is, of course, has its Masonic correlations, and with a feeling of complete destitution, I will say, Masons. will recognize the associations. Destitution and blindness. Because, you know, the secrets of initiation are not what we imagine them to be. If working from our own or our old presumptions, it's something quite new. And maybe often we are shocked to realize the nature of the newness to which we are being exposed. The disciple needs to bear in mind that he has to become a moving point and hence a line. Now, will that point wax and wane in strength? Probably. There will be moments of brighter illumination and moments of apparent retrogression. He ascends towards the hierarchy and assumes the correct spiritual attitude. But at the same time, he descends into what he erroneously regards as the depth of human difficulty and iniquity, if necessary. You know, thrown into some very perhaps sordid circumstances, S-O-R-D-I-D, preserving always his spiritual integrity, but learning three important lessons. So this describes the disciple's mode of movement. In other words, just because we venture towards the high does not mean we will not be exposed to that which is low. And perhaps more so, which is why we often find disciples in very difficult situations needing redemption. They have to take what the point of tension on high reveals to them. They have to take it. And then they have to apply it in the places that are low. And that's, you know, part of the redemptive task, to take what is high and apply it in the areas that really need redemption. And maybe in your life, there are certain to be such areas, difficult areas, disagreeable areas, areas that don't feel like progress. Look at Hercules in Gemini, the sign of great brotherhood and service. He raced along, hoping to find the golden apples of the Hesperides, which represented symbolically wisdom. But he was always being stopped. Okay, he didn't recognize Nereus, the intuition. He had to deal with Antaeus, the precursor of heavier glamours lying ahead. He was stopped for a long time by the false teacher Bucyrus. And then Prometheus was in trouble, and he found it in his conscience that he needed to help to free Prometheus. And then, just when he thinks he's really getting close, Atlas is having a hard time and needs help holding up the world. And it's interesting that these apparent delays, when understood by him and when entered into fully, actually sped him on his way towards the reception of the golden apples. It's the person who selfishly runs ahead without considering others that is actually delaying his acquisition of the apples. Well, we've all had a very checkered past, and the past of every one of us as an emanation of the One is unique, and we will encounter those kinds of experiences which are suitable, karmically demanded of us, and dharmically indicative. And maybe everyone will encounter something a little different, but the general idea is brought forward in the myths and in the labors of Hercules. Okay, now, so he may descend into very difficult situations, helping people who appear almost to be beyond help. But somehow he knows how to keep his spiritual integrity, and he learns three important lessons. What are these lessons? The recognition that he shares all human tendencies, good and bad, and hence is able to serve. He is adequate to meet the kind of experience he encounters. It may be good, it may be bad, but he can draw from his own experiences something that will allow him to function serviceably with respect to the person who presents him with certain behaviors. Now, this one's a really good one. And I wonder if we agree with it. While maintaining his spiritual integrity, he learns. The discovery that the thing he most despises and fears, because we often hate what we fear, is the thing which exists most strongly in him, but which is as yet unrecognized. He discovers also that he has to explore and know these despised and feared areas of consciousness so that they can become eventually an asset instead of something to be avoided. Because if we run in the other direction and are not compelled by a sense of duty, we accomplish nothing. He learns to fear nothing. He is all things. Now, these are powerful statements, and I've often repeated that we are the one, we are the, finally, after all the unveiling, we are the universal logos, and within us is every tendency. And in a supra-universal sense, we are far more. What's he learning? He is a human being, but he is also a mystic, an occultist, a psychic, a disciple. All these things he is. And because of all these acquired states of consciousness, he can eventually become a master who recognizes all this within himself. He has mastered all stages and states of awareness. Well, you know, so much for saying, you may be like that, but I'm like this. And to say so in a somewhat proud and egotistical manner. So much for that. We have everything within ourselves. We have mastered all stages of behavior and expression. And then, point number three, the uselessness of past attitudes, glamours, and dogmatic ways of looking at life and people, based usually on tradition and circumstance. When they separate him from his fellow men, let's just say, the uselessness of regret. Of the great heresy of separateness. Now, this is a powerful statement. When he has learned, but really learned, these three things, all the time preserving his spiritual integrity, then indeed he is initiate. So he's sharing all human tendencies. Now, there's a lot of people who think so much of the sanctity of Jesus, let's say, that they could never attribute to him the realization that he has had, or even has within him, all human tendencies, good and bad, which of course makes it possible for him to recognize them in others and deal properly. And this is the one that usually stops people in their tracks. This sense of seeing the very thing which one most despises and fears, and that this very thing exists most strongly within himself. Now, just think about that. What is it that you despise most strongly and fear? And can you find it within yourself? Or are you busy, as so many are, projecting it on others? That's going to be a humbling realization. And when somebody, as they say, really gets our goat, you know, when they really disturb us because of how they are, is it really possible that what we think we're seeing in them is existing most strongly in us? I can maybe use an example from myself, you know. When someone puts his hand to the plow and turns back, the Bible tells us he's not worthy to enter the kingdom of heaven. I say, why doesn't that person just keep going? Because they're on the right track. Why do they turn back? Can it be that I would discover in myself the tendency, maybe not acted upon anymore, but existing as a past tendency and even a present possibility to turn back? It's not a pleasant thought that that could be the condition in which my psyche exists. What is it for you? And probably there's more than one thing. And if you find yourself harping on certain people, pointing the finger. That finger is pointing right back at you. And these are some of the secrets of the occult path. Not easy to assimilate. Humbling. And because they are humbling, they help us remove the veils. But it's a good thing to know human nature inside out, and the Master does know human nature inside out. And the Christ, above all, knows human nature inside out. I mean, above all, in our humanity. Well, anyway, the state of fearlessness enters. And here come these statements which can be so easily overlooked. He learns to fear nothing. He is all things. And that takes us back to that second ray mantra, not is but me. That doesn't mean you have to be on the second ray, but somehow we all share all of those seven words of power, and maybe the one connected with our soul ray, given our present state of development, most strongly. It's most strongly represented in us. So for the second ray soul, not is, but me. And then we just finally cannot be separative. And we cannot rely upon the past when we are trying to make our way into the initiatic future. So there are a lot of enigmas, riddles on the path here. And we have to be open and ready, really, to encounter the new and the unexpected. Well, this is going to take us to we really haven't covered a lot of pages. I know I'm speaking quite slowly, so it's hard to cover pages when you're speaking so slowly, but it goes up to page 709. And that's where we will begin when right now, I'm not doing these very, very lengthy programs because it's not, working for me to do that right now for various reasons. And this takes us from 707 to 709, and we'll begin program number 9 with page 709, and whether it will be today or whether it can be later, it just depends. So friends, thank you for being with us. Study hard these matters, and I hope that a little something of what I'm elaborating that you find useful somehow. And this will be sent to Makara and also to our YouTube YouTube program, our YouTube channel. So we'll continue here. We still have quite a few pages, maybe another 70, 80 pages here. So we're not done by any means. And deep matters are taken up. Okay. Thank you. Lots of love from all of us and everyone on the communications team. We'll be seeing you soon.